As you know far too well from listening to Useful Idiots, the 2024 election is coming fast. And while we can't predict for sure which candidate will win, we do know that either way, everyone else in the world will lose. Unless there was a fun and easy way to make a little extra cash on the whole terrible contest. That's right. Betting's not just for sports fans anymore. Now it's the political junkies' time to shine. We figure that if we spend all our time on Twitter anyway, following the election and endless political analysis, why not put our knowledge to the test? It's MyBookie, a new sports book that lets you bet on the 2024 election from the general election down to who will win each state. If the world is crashing anyway, why not cash in? Don't miss out on this. Pick a side, use promo code USEFUL to double your first deposit and instantly start with a leg up, only with MyBookie. Since this is a podcast, you can only hear me right now, but if you could see me, you'd be saying, whoa, who is that? It's me, Katie Helper. I'm just wearing the new fashion line from American Giant. Since 2011, they've been making high-quality, long-lasting, timeless American clothes, including their classic Full Zip, which was named the greatest hoodie ever made by Slate Magazine. Right now, I'm wearing the very stylish Moto dress, perfect for feeling sporty and sleek, made with their soft and stretchy French terry fabric, and Aaron got the roughneck chore jacket, so he's looking good throughout his endlessly busy schedule. From activewear to work fits to the latest fashion picks, American Giant has it all. When most apparel companies have shipped too much overseas, making cheap disposable clothes and creating complicated global supply chains, American Giant stands for simple, local, high-quality goods. It's the kind of difference you'll feel and appreciate for years to come. When you buy American Giant, you create local jobs in towns that help stitch communities together. Get 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com when you use the code USEFUL at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com, code USEFUL. Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm one of your hosts, Katie Helper.
And I'm the other host, Aaron Matek. How are you, Katie?
I'm good. You?
I'm great. I'm great.
Cool.
It's holiday time.
Holiday time.
Yeah.
That's all I got to say about that.
It's holiday time.
That's all you got to say. You don't know which holiday Aaron's talking about. You don't know which one he celebrates. But it is the most wonderful time of the year, whether you celebrate Kwanzaa, Christmas, or Hanukkah. I actually did a little latkes party. I forgot that latkes are for, well, I don't know if I could say I forgot. Okay. What's one thing you really got to have at a latkes party besides the latkes?
It's been a long time since I had a latke. Isn't applesauce a really big thing?
Yes. But besides the food, there was applesauce, there was sour cream, there were latkes. Uh-huh. A latkes party can also be called a Hanukkah party. Mm-hmm. So what do you need for Hanukkah?
Oh, the menorah.
The menorah, which I forgot. So I had some people over for latkes, but we just made a makeshift one out of some tea candles.
Hanukkah, I think, should be rebranded and changed into celebrating the time when you and your friends made a makeshift menorah rather than celebrating the time when the fictional time, because I think all this is fiction, when Jews somehow saved the temple. I don't know. I forget the story now.
They got oil to burn for 8 days, right?
Yeah. Every Hanukkah from now on, I'm going to be celebrating a makeshift menorah. That's what I'm going to be honoring.
That's the real Hanukkah miracle. Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you sign up at usefulidiots.substack.com, you get bonus content, including our extended interviews, also our Thursday throwdown, and you can take part in the absurd arena where you interact with other Useful Idiots and ask us questions. So Wilson, what do we have this week from the absurd arena?
So for the holiday edition of the absurd arena, the Useful Idiots are giving out presents to our favorite politicians who have sucked all year. And we asked what presents would you give to each politician? So we got a couple similar answers. J.L. Albrecht said, every politician who voted for military aid to Ukraine should get an all expenses paid, fun-filled weekend in exotic Bakhmut, Ukraine. And who wouldn't want to go? Ukraine is crushing the Russians in Bakhmut, the Western press constantly says. Russia is out of missiles and ammunition everywhere. What's the danger?
Yeah, sure. It's true. That's a good idea. Let's send all these politicians to Ukraine to see for themselves the fruits of their labors of funneling all this money into the weapons industry. Let's do it. I'm on board with that.
Do it. Yeah.
So Useful Idiot Juno Nana had a similar idea. They would gift a year of living the life of an American citizen after losing their low-wage, no-benefits job and home.
So that would be a great gift for every lawmaker to have, to actually experience what it's like to be a real person and not a servant of the elite. I totally support that gift, too. That's a great idea.
I mean, I agree with Aaron. I'd say for all the pals.
And yes. Finally, useful idiot Howie said, unnecessarily large dildos for every representative and senator.
I mean, that's such a subjective thing. I don't know how you define unnecessarily large, but sure, that's a good way to spread the holiday cheer.
Katie, I appreciate your dildo inclusivity there. You're really trying to acknowledge that the size of a dildo really depends on the eyes of the beholder. So really,
exactly, yeah.
What constitutes a unnecessary large dildo? You know,
yeah, that's we can't decide that.
No, yeah, fair enough. Well, so sorry,
there are
Hallie.
No absolutes.
Yeah. Sorry, we're giving everyone the dildo size that they want.
Exactly, of their choice. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, that has been the absurd arena for this week.
Yeah. Good job, guys. All righty. Shall we go to the four basic food groups?
Let's do it. What do we have for Democrat suck?
Okay. So for Democrat suck, we have an interesting piece of primary source evidence. We actually have a video. It was posted by Mint Press, although Mint Press did not take this video. Someone named Damon Magsudi did. And let's just play the video. And this is Joe Biden at an event in California. Let's play the video.
President Biden, could you please announce that JCPOA is dead? Can you just announce that?
No.
No, why not?
No.
We just don't want any deals with the mothers. No deals. They don't represent us. They are not our government.
So basically, you have a woman at an event in California. She says, President Biden, could you please announce that JCPOA is dead? Can you just announce that? And that's a reference to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or otherwise known as the Iran nuclear deal. So he says it's dead.
Yeah, he's basically announcing this huge policy shift to someone, to some random person who's asking the question in line. That's like a really big exclusive for this audience member. Right. Oh my God, the Iran nuclear deal is officially dead.
Yeah, she got a real scoop, a major scoop, this woman waiting online.
Huge scoop. And yes, you know, look, this is embarrassing for people like myself, who one of the reasons why I was publicly advocating a Biden election victory back when he was running against Trump was that I at least thought that on some issues, Biden would be better, including I expected that Biden would return to his own nuclear deal. That's the nuclear deal that was reached under the Obama-Biden administration, right, which Trump killed. So I figured, as Biden had said on the campaign trail, that he would return to it. But he can't even go back to his own deal. And now he's announcing privately to some random person in line that it's dead.
Yeah, it's a private-public partnership, I would say. Private-public partnership announcement.
Yeah, so, well,
I don't know if he knew he was being recorded or what.
Yeah, well, it's a really interesting way to get the news out that you're killing vital international arms control treaty to tell some random audience member waiting for you in line.
Yeah, it's a really interesting press conference technique.
Maybe if he declares World War III, he can announce that to some lucky fan next time he goes home to Delaware or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, why not?
And this person is obviously a hardliner on Iran.
Oh, yeah. Well, they don't want any deals at all with the Iranian government. Yeah. And they want to obviously keep the sanctions on Iran, which is what this deal was about. The deal was basically Iran limits its nuclear program in exchange for the U.S. stops trying to strangle its people, trying to deprive them of the basics like food and medicine by lifting these sanctions. And it worked. The deal was working fine, as everyone involved acknowledges. Iran was in compliance, but it was Trump who came in and killed it. And Biden is siding with Trump rather than his own prior administration's agreement.
One thing that's funny is that Biden has this kind of aside, kind of under his breath, after the woman says that we just don't want any deals with the mullahs, no deals, they don't represent us, they're not our government. He says they'll have a nuclear weapon they'll represent. I think he's kind of implying like, okay, it's great that you say that they don't represent you, but they'll represent a nuclear weapon. He's almost undermining his own position.
Because the position he's advocating would make it easier for Iran's nuclear program to restart. Now, of course, it's the view of U.S. intelligence that Iran has abandoned its nuclear weapons program a long time ago, but it hasn't abandoned its nuclear program, at least now that the U.S. killed the deal. It's resumed the enrichment of uranium, which puts it on an easier path to building a nuclear weapon. In terms of actually building a nuclear weapon, there's no sign that it actually wants to do that. But certainly killing the Iran nuclear deal makes it easier for Iran to do that. And so that is Biden's right. current policy.
Yeah. Democrats suck and are surprisingly accessible when you want to get them to say something. What do we have for Republicans suck?
Well, Congress is about to vote on a new spending bill for Ukraine, another $44 billion. Incidentally, that's like the same price I think that Elon Musk paid for Twitter. So there's a theme this year of exorbitant price tags in the form of $44 billion for, I think, really unnecessary things. But just to show how bipartisan this is, Republicans, there's some talk sometimes that Republicans are going to stand up to the war machine and not approve all this more money for the military-industrial complex. Where here is Senator Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader of the Republicans, on his view on funding the proxy war in Ukraine.
Making sure the Defense Department can deal with the major threats coming from Russia and China. Providing assistance for the Ukrainians to defeat the Russians. That's the number one priority for the United States right now, according to most Republicans. That's sort of how we see the challenges confronting the country at the moment.
So that's Senator Mitch McConnell. He says that the number one priority right now for the U.S. is providing assistance to Ukraine to defeat the Russians. That's certainly the number one priority for the Democrats. And here's Mitch McConnell just voicing how bipartisan this policy is. And let's look at one result of this policy. This is a recent headline in the New York Times. Military spending surges, creating new boom for arms makers. The combination of the war in Ukraine and concern about longer-term threats from Russia and China is driving a bipartisan push to increase U.S. capacity to produce weapons. So there it is, folks, bipartisanship in action. And this article in the Times talks about, first of all, just what a great thing the war in Ukraine has been for arms makers. The producer of Stinger missiles says, like, we're running out of Stingers. We have to make more because they fired so much in Ukraine, which is great for Lockheed Martin. And it also talks about, for the first time, talk of a $1 trillion Pentagon budget. $1 trillion. That is now seen as a real possibility in Washington.
I mean, it's beautiful. What I like about this Republican suck is that it could be a Democrat suck. It shows how bipartisan this consensus is. It really gives me faith in the bipartisan nature of our political system.
It really is. It's a beautiful dance. The dance
beautiful
of
dance.
War profiteering.
Yeah.
All right. What do we have for Isn't That Weird?
So for Isn't That Weird, we have a story about Jenna Bush Hager. And now what we need to tell you, in case you don't know this, is that Jenna Bush has joined the Today Show with Hoda and Jenna. It's now called Today with Hoda and Jenna. And her 9-year-old daughter had an announcement to make to Hoda, because Jenna and Hoda are getting to know each other as they're starting to host this show together. So her 9-year-old daughter, Myla, had the following to say.
Just one tiny one.
She never wears underwear.
Oh. Okay. Bye.
We love you, Myla. Oh, yes,
she does. She's not wearing it right now. I saw her change.
Bye, love you.
That was her 9-year-old daughter, Myla, really embarrassing her mother, revealing that she not only does she never wear underwear, but obviously if that policy is never, she's not wearing it right then and there on that very set. Now, it's not, I don't want to shame. I don't want to commando shame anyone. But what's weird, it's weirder to me that they announced this on television.
Yeah, it's also weird to me that these children of former presidents.
War criminals.
Get correspondent jobs on right. the Today Show. So George W. Bush's daughter is a correspondent, and also Chelsea Clinton for a while worked as a correspondent too.
Meghan McCain, of course, was on the
Meghan McCain. Oh my God. Yeah. Alicia Menendez on MSNBC. I think she's the daughter of Robert Menendez.
Yeah. Senator yeah. Bob Menendez. Yeah. Do you want to know why she doesn't wear underwear? Because I looked into this a little bit.
Oh, yes, please. I'm dying to know. Dying to know.
It's for the silhouette. You don't have a so-called VPL, visible panty line.
Okay. So, and it's such a bad thing to have a underwear line.
I guess so. Going? For some people, okay. It is. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Little life hack for people who don't like having a VPL. You just don't wear the P, and then there's no VPL. Without the P, you can't get the VL.
Well, one of the Bush families.
And now I just realized Bush. Wow, that's interesting.
One of the Bush family's best contributions to humanity right there.
Yeah. I mean, I would have really preferred if it had stopped there and not with the Iraq war.
Sure. Yeah. This is their way of giving back, I guess. With life hacks like this.
A Bush bombshell, if you will.
All right. So for Isn't That Terrible, check out Republican Congress member Mike Gallagher on CNN talking about why he thinks TikTok needs to be banned in the U.S.
TikTok is a popular app that is from China. You have a bill to ban TikTok completely nationally over its ties to China and because of national security risks. For the 100 million TikTok users in the U.S., including two-thirds of teenagers, including two teenagers I know very well, what information could the Chinese government be collecting about them, and should they delete that app?
They should, and I recognize, particularly as a younger member of Congress, this will make me very unpopular with your teenagers and many others, but the fundamental problem is this, Jake. TikTok is owned by ByteDance, and ByteDance is effectively controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. The editor-in-chief of ByteDance, for example, is a CCP secretary and has talked about making sure all product lines, all business lines follow appropriate political control. So the question we have to ask is whether we want to give the CCP the ability to track our location, track what websites we visit, even when we're not using the TikTok app itself. And increasingly, since a large percentage of young Americans use TikTok to get their news, whether we want them to have the ability to selectively edit that news. It's as if in 1958, given that TikTok is on the cusp of becoming the most powerful media company in America, we would have allowed the KGB and Pravda to buy the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, the Washington Post, all combined. I think this is a bad idea, and I'm proud to say that my bill is now bipartisan. I have a Democrat, Raj Krishnamoorthy, who is joining me in introducing it. We've heard Senator Mark Warner voice concerns in the Senate. So my hope is that we make that bipartisan case, and now every member of the Senate is on record saying that TikTok is a national security concern and that it should be banned from government phones. So we're making the case, but we have a long way to go legislatively.
What does he think is going to happen? Like the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, is going to edit the news offerings of teenagers in Iowa? Don't you think that the Chinese government probably has better things to do than to try to like care about what teenagers in the U.S. are posting on TikTok? That's assuming China even has the kind of control over TikTok that this lawmaker says they do, which I doubt, but it's pretty paranoid.
I mean, I like the way he uses the Communist Party. He just throws it in there to, it's just fear mongering. It's not really relevant what party is in power in China.
Right. Well, they love saying that, they love saying Communist Party wherever there is one, so they can use that to fearmonger. That's an old playbook. And meanwhile, what's interesting is you don't see the kind of concern expressed about China's potential influence over TikTok. You don't see the same kind of concern expressed about the U.S. government's role in spreading propaganda at home. And we just got a new leak about that via the Twitter file. So let's go to just a bit of Li Fang's latest reporting based on the internal documents from Twitter, where he talks about the Pentagon being involved in a huge influence operation using Twitter. So here's Li Fang, how Twitter quietly aided the Pentagon's covert online PSYOP campaign. Despite promises to shut down covert state-run propaganda networks, Twitter docs show that the social media giant Twitter directly assisted the U.S. military's influence operations. Behind the scenes, Twitter gave approval and special protection to the U.S. military's online psychological influence ops. Despite knowledge that Pentagon propaganda accounts used covert identities, Twitter did not suspend many for around 2 years or more. Some remain active.
Yeah, I would love to see a law about that. I'd love to see someone introduce a bill about that.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. And if it does happen, it will only be after years of this being allowed to happen and nobody caring, because, you know, lawmakers in Congress don't care about domestic propaganda. They only care about the threat of foreign propaganda, real or imagined. But domestic propaganda, totally fine.
Well, that's part of the reason is because they don't want our domestic propaganda undermined by any potential competing narratives.
There we go.
Or even corrected by non-narratives, just reality.
That's right.
But that is our lane. The propaganda lane is our lane, not anyone else's lane. You know, it also is a very important reminder to me that we need to be on TikTok, Aaron.
Oh, yeah? We're not on TikTok?
No, I think we got to do it. I'm never on TikTok, but I barely use it. I gotta get better at it.
Yeah, I've never used it. So, but apparently that's where the kids
are.
Is that
because you're a patriot? Is that why you've never used
exactly.
It?
Yes, that's why. That's why. Yes. Yes. It's
Well, I'm glad that, you know, Jake Tapper revealed that he had a conflict of interest, potential conflict of interest, when he revealed his own teenage kids use TikTok.
That was an important disclosure. It's good to be transparent in your journalism. Exactly. Good job, Jake.
So those are the four basic food groups. Now make sure you join us at Substack, usefulidiots.substack.com, so you can see our Thursday throwdown, where we bring you your midweek dose of media madness. And for everyone else, we're going to proceed to our interview. We're so excited to be speaking to Miko Peled, who is a speaker, activist, and author. He's the author of the excellent book, The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And in this book, The General Son, which is really excellent, I can't recommend it enough, you learn about Miko Peled, how he went from the son of a decorated Israeli general and a proud Zionist to an anti-Zionist. It's really fascinating.
All right, let's go to Miko Peled.
Welcome, Miko Peled. So great to be talking to you.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
So Israel has, once again, Benjamin Netanyahu as a prime minister. How did this happen? And talk about the coalition that he is assembling to rule over Israel once again.
Well, I think it was obvious that he was going to come back. I don't think there was any doubt in anybody's mind. The previous government that was formed without him never stood a chance, and it was only possible because of all kinds of coalition trickery that couldn't possibly have held for a long time. So I think his return was inevitable. Israelis see him as really the only grown-up, the only real serious politician, and it's true, he is the only serious politician. He's a better politician and a better leader, you know, than anyone out there in the Israeli political spectrum or the Israeli political reality. Now, what's interesting is that he had two choices. He could create a very broad coalition with the people who ran against him, which would be kind of in Israeli terms, Israeli political terms, that would be considered kind of, you know, centrist, and continue along the path that Israel has been continuing, which is to destroy Palestine, to maintain this very brutal apartheid regime, but do it in a way that presents, that's, you know, packaged nicely, packaged the way that particularly liberals in America can handle, can swallow. The other option was to go with the Netanyahu bloc, which are politicians, political groups that remain loyal to him throughout the whole thing, knowing that at one point he's going to come back and they will be rewarded. So he opted for the second choice. He opted to reward these, you know, to describe them, they're thugs, they're gangsters, they're criminals and they're criminals, and they're not, and they're proud of it. They're not trying to hide it. They're not trying to look diplomatic. They are thugs, and that's it. And he opted to go with them, I think, for two reasons. One is that ideologically, I think they're closer to him than anybody else. Now, all Israeli, you know, politicians support the racist apartheid regime, but this is a new form of violence that we're going to be seeing. And he's given these people, particularly Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are the biggest, you know, the leaders of this gang, of these gangs, he has given them a seat at the most sensitive seats within the Israeli government. The one is basically Homeland Security, which is now called Homeland Security. It used to be called something else. And it's tailored for Ben-Gvir. He will be in charge of the police. He'll be in charge of the policing in the West Bank. He'll be charged with the Border Patrol, which is kind of a militarized police unit that is used against Palestinians in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And the jurisdiction is unprecedented. Smotrich is going to apparently have the treasury in his hands, but also a seat in the Ministry of Defense, which governs the life of Palestinians. So between these two men, the lives of Palestinians are going to be governed. Between these two men who are dedicated more than anyone to the expulsion of all Palestinians, to terrorizing Palestinians, and to the destruction of Al-Aqsa and building a temple, a so-called Jewish temple in its place. They will have, and in the past, you know, they were acting in order to achieve these goals, but, and whenever they acted, they could get away with it. Now it's more than that. Now they are going to be sitting at the table with the budgets. They will be creating policy. They will be enacting legislation that will make all of this, you know, at a much wider scale, on a much wider scale. So in a word, in a sentence, I would say Palestinians are going to be looking back at this, at the years leading up to this government as the good old days. Now, granted, this year has been a record year in terms of killing the Palestinians. They're going to be looking at this year as the good old days. What is coming up is the worst that Palestinians have ever suffered. It's coming up. It's around the corner. Provided, of course, this government takes a seat.
Let's talk a bit more about Itamar Ben-Gvir and the tradition he comes from. So we have a few clips here. Here he is videoed in Hebron, a Palestinian town, which is occupied by Israeli settlers, where he's leading an attack on a Palestinian shop owner. So let's look at this clip. And he's the man in white. So that's Itamar Ben-Gvir leading a mob attack on a Palestinian shop owner in Hebron. And this is a clip of Ben-Gvir as a younger man dressed up as Baruch Goldstein, who is the Jewish settler who massacred scores of Palestinian worshipers in the occupied West Bank. And so this is Ben-Gvir dressed up as Baruch Goldstein for Purim, for the holiday of Purim. And maybe, Miko, after this clip, you can translate for us what he says.
המצלמה אינה רצויה בפורים בקריה, למעט תחרות תחפושות שתיארך הערב בסתר באחד הבתים.
יש לנו פה חלוק של רופא, מדים של סרן, כידוע דוקטור גושטה נכנס עם מדים של סרן למערה. כמובן, אלמנטים של רפואה, זקן פאות כמו של דוקטור גולדשטיין.
יש כאלה שמתחפשים למרדכי יהודי, יש כאלה שמתחפשים לאסתר המלכה. הגיבור שלי זה דוקטור גולדשטיין, ואני מתחפש לדוקטור גולדשטיין, לגיבור שלי.
So that's Itamar Ben-Gvir as a younger man dressing up as his hero, Baruch Goldstein, whose photograph he had up on his wall for many years until there was a recent outcry. I think the forced him to take it down. But talk to us about the movement that Ben-Gvir comes from and why he worships people like Baruch Goldstein.
Yes, and I think these two clips show two interesting things about Ben-Gvir. The first one, you see he's in the back. He's scared to death. He's a coward. He's not up front in the confrontation with the Palestinians. He's in the back, and only when there's nobody around, he grabs that one rail and throws the clothes on the floor. He's in the back scared to death. So he's a coward. And the second clip, he says, you know, people, it's Purim, which is kind of a Jewish version of Halloween. And he goes, you know, people dress up as whatever heroes they choose, a king this, a queen that. My hero is, and he calls him Dr. Goldstein, Baruch Goldstein, who's a mass murderer. This movement of these gangs is something that was developed when this marriage between Zionism and Judaism became a thing, became real. These are the settlers. These are the people who decided to take over the West Bank after 1967. And they are a brand of Zionism, which is, you know, just, they're just racist thugs. They're gangs. They operate outside the law. They are the law. They feel that they are the law. And the reality is that Israel always encouraged them although never took responsibility for their actions. So, for example, if they would go, and particularly in Hebron, is a good example, because Hebron is kind of like the microcosm of the occupation. In Hebron, they would go take over a home, for example, or they would start to, you know, or take off to take over a bunch of homes in a neighborhood, or the government would stay away for a little bit, but then very quickly, army would come to protect them. Very quickly, the electricity would be, and the water would be running. Very quickly, they had a road, an access road that allowed them to be wherever they want to be without having to go through Palestinians. And laws were passed, or not laws, military orders will be passed, limiting Palestinian access to these people. So, you know, although the government always would always distance themselves from them, they always supported them. And that's why in the most remote parts of the West Bank, where Palestinians have no access to water or electricity, as soon as there's a settlement or roads, as soon as there's a settlement or an outpost, as they call it, they have the army presence, they have roads, they have electricity, they have water, they have everything they need immediately. And now what's happened is the government kind of ignored them. Official Israel ignored these people and allowed them to grow. They grew beyond the scope of their own constituency. In other words, it's no longer just these religious fanatics. They've spread into kind of the more secular, what you might call mainstream Israel, and into the army. They have a huge influence. And so now two things have happened. One is that they are actually going to get a seat at the table. They have the third largest block in the Knesset. And just as an example, a few elections ago, the Joint List, which is a list of predominantly Palestinian parties, also had the third largest block in the Knesset, but they had absolutely no authority. They got nothing. These guys are the third largest block, and they're going to get not just a seat at the table, but a seat in the most sensitive security-related portfolios in the government, which is extremely, extremely troubling. Another thing is, these people are also connected to the movement to rebuild the temple. And for decades, they've been conducting tours. And in the beginning, you'd have 10, 15 people walk with them. In recent years, in the last few years, they would have 50, 60, 80, 90,000 people per year joining these tours. I went on those tours twice. Once when it was just a regular day, and once this summer during Tisha B'Av, which is the day Jews commemorate the destruction of the temple. So there were a lot more people going, and the government provided them with much more security and so on. And so these people are they're zealots. They're dedicated, and they're going to make the life of Palestinians worse than it ever was. And they're going to do everything they can in order to bring about the destruction of Al-Aqsa, and perhaps even go as far as building a temple. We'll see how that goes. But that is definitely where they're going with this. They do not see options other than complete destruction of anything that was Palestinian and the building of this new Israel, the way they view it, which is a very, completely racist and completely zealot as they are.
Miko, you are a very outspoken, obviously, critic of Israel. You support the one-state solution, which we'll get into shortly. But I wanted you to just share with people how your own biography influenced your political ideology for people who haven't read your book, The General Son.
Well, if they haven't read the book yet, I suggest they drop everything and go read my book immediately, obviously. So I was raised in a very, very patriotic family, Zionist family. My father was a general in the Israeli army. I had an uncle who was the president of Israel, a grandfather who signed the Declaration of Independence, and other people who were very actively involved in the establishment of the State of Israel. And so the people that I would meet as a child, you know, family gatherings and social gatherings, were these kind of people, people who had this, you know, a seat at the table, if you will, at the establishment of Israel, and then, you know, the running of the country. And then after 1967, which is when my father was still in uniform, he became one of those people who started speaking about this idea of a two-state solution. where the Palestinians would get the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, and that would be a little Palestinian state, and then everything would be fine. Today, we know that that idea is absurd. It never stood a chance. It was just an attempt to lock up enough Palestinians in open-air prisons so that Israel could maintain the facade of a Jewish majority state within Israel. But, you know, moving forward, that was, you know, the rest of his life after he retired from the army. That was kind of where he went. He even met with the Yasser Arafat when Arafat began, you know, engaging with Israelis and so on. And then I got actually involved as an activist only later on, after my father passed away, after my niece was killed in a bombing in Jerusalem, in a suicide attack in Jerusalem. That was the thing that kind of pushed me to really engage. And so I did, and having engaged and taken that, you know, that journey into Palestine as an Israeli, I began to meet with Palestinians and talk with Palestinians and think with Palestinians and protest with Palestinians and resist as much as I could, or join the resistance as an active participant against the state of Israel, against the occupation and so on. So that's kind of, you know, in short, the biography and what led me to do what I do today. And then I realized at one point, at a very specific point, I should say, that the two-state solution is not just an impossibility, but it was a lie to begin with. You know, the attempt to somehow lock up Palestinians in certain areas so that Israel could continue to govern them but not include them, govern them but not count them, is really an attempt to maintain the apartheid regime and to maintain the pretense of a Jewish majority within what they call the Greater Israel, from the river to the sea. And, you know, personally, I can't live with that. I can't support something like that. I cannot support the racism. I certainly can't support the violence. And the longer I'm involved in this, the longer I participate in this, of course, the more friends you make, the more people you know, it becomes very personal. So to me, this issue is not, you know, some theoretical academic debate. This is very personal. In other words, when I say life for Palestinians is going to be worse, I mean that for friends of mine who live in Hebron, Is Amro, or friends of mine who live in Abi Saleh, like the Tamimi, Basim Tamimi and his family, they might not be alive tomorrow. Their home might be demolished tomorrow. One of them might be shot or arrested tomorrow morning. And I have no control over that. You know, I could be in Jerusalem, and that happened many times, while Israel is bombing Gaza. It's a 45-minute drive, and there's nothing I can do. I could drive there, but I can't go in. Of course, I can't stop the bombing. So it's very, very personal. The frustration is personal, too. And the desire to do something comes from that, you know, sense of, you know, connection and the deep relationship that I have with the place and the people, the Palestinians who are involved.
You mentioned that you had a specific moment where you realized that the two-state solution was not a viable option. Can you talk about what that moment was and why it's not a viable option?
Yeah, sure. So I was actually in the West Bank in the village of Bilayin. It was 2005. And I walked, this is before the wall was built. They're just preparing, the construction for the wall was just in the works, right on the lands of the people in Bilayin. And across the other side is a settlement called Modi'in Elite, which is a settlement, it's a big city that was built there. And so we walked through the area that was to be the wall into the settlement and walked around and talked to some of the settlers. It was very interesting. I describe it in the book in detail. But I took a look around me and I realized the settlements are not going anywhere because these are not small little farms or I don't know, little villages. They're massively building cities. And we're talking about billions and billions of dollars of investment. Roads and highways and schools and shopping malls for Jews only on Palestinian land. And then it kind of hit me, this is permanent. This is not going anywhere. So the one state, the single state option is actually in place as we speak. And it's been in place for a very long time. If we don't like this reality where there is a single state, but it's an apartheid state, it's a very violent apartheid state, then the only other option is to resist, oppose that state, delegitimize it, and fight for a real democracy with equal rights. Because why do we need, and I thought as an Israeli, why do I want to be separated from the Palestinians? I mean, why in the world would anybody want to be separated and create walls and all kinds of segregation and checkpoint? For why? Why not just all of us live where we live and, you know, like normal people do? And I realized that it kind of all came into place. It all kind of fit the puzzle that this is actually the two-state solution is a lie. And the only other option that exists for Palestine is a free, democratic Palestine, one person, one vote, full equality. And to me, that's, you know, if for people of conscience, that it should be the goal. That should be what we're talking about. That should be where we're going. We need to support the Palestinians, or better still, engage with the Palestinians as part of the resistance. You know, be part of the resistance, resist with them in whichever way we can. I mean, if we live in the United States or we live in Europe, then there are many things that we can do to participate with the Palestinians in terms of demanding sanctions, for example, demanding that Israel is boycotted, demanding that Israel is eliminated from sporting events, from academic spaces, from cultural events, and so on in each particular place. So participating in, to me, that is a calling. I think we have, particularly in America, where we pay so much money to the state of Israel and basically fund to a very large degree the apartheid regime, it's our duty to stand up with the Palestinians and demand justice. But there's no question that there are only two options in Palestine: calling the whole country Israel and keeping Palestinians without rights, which is, by the way, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and that entire group, that's what they believe in, that Palestinians should be given three choices: to live without rights and remain, to leave, or to fight and die. Those are three choices Palestinians should be given. And the reality is that, you know, this is true. So we either fight with the Palestinians and resist, or things will never change. This is a reality that exists today in Israel. It's an apartheid regime. If anybody has any doubt, you know, there's an Amnesty report. It's only about 280 pages long. It's easy to read, and it should be read, particularly by Americans who, like I said, support financially the apartheid regime.
It seems that over the last year, there have been increased Israeli raids on the occupied West Bank. The attacks on Gaza are very routine, as are the attacks on the West Bank. But it seems as if, and correct me if I'm wrong, that Israeli raids on the West Bank, especially towns like Jenin, are getting deadlier. Am I wrong about that? Has there been an intensification of Israeli raids against the West Bank, or is this just business as usual? And talk about what's been happening.
No, the attacks this year on the West Bank have increased by a lot. There's a policy that was put in place, which is to destroy the armed resistance that was developing in Jenin and Nablus, particularly in that area, like you said. And so we see an intensification of Israeli attacks on these cities because of that. It's an official policy. In other words, they talk about it on the news, they talk about it in the papers. You know, the spokespeople of the army and the government talk about this. And each particular case, what they call an operation, it's very clear that it's part of this larger campaign to destroy the armed resistance cells that have been built and created in Nablus and Jenin. And many of the attacks that we saw against Israelis over the last year were initiated by those. But no, there's definitely a campaign to attack and destroy. And it's interesting in that when these so-called operations take place, of course, Israeli media is all over it. They tell you how many brigades of paratroopers, how many brigades of, you know, special forces, how many brigades of this and that and the other, how many helicopters. you know, it's a massive military operation. If, you know, a soldier gets hurt, boom, he's air evacuated, the helicopter's right there, there's a makeshift hospital. I mean, everything is taken care of. When the soldiers get back home, back to their base, they have, you know, a good meal and they celebrate. Who's on the other side? A bunch of guys with jeans and a t-shirt, maybe an M16 and a handful of bullets. That's it. If they get hurt, if they get hurt, they're going to die. You know, they're going to bleed to death. Israel doesn't allow ambulances to get in and get these people. And many of the ambulances in the West Bank are empty. It's not like a proper ambulance that has everything you need. They're empty. It's just a shell. It's just a van, basically. But of course, we've seen that there's plenty of images where the Israeli army does not allow them to come in. So you have, on the one hand, this massive operation, military operation. Oh, and there's dogs, too. They have a special unit, canine unit. And I think it was in August. I think it was the operation where they killed Ibrahim Nabulsi. He was a big hero, you know, very charismatic leader in Nablus. One of the dogs was killed in the operation. And it was front page news in the Israeli papers. This dog was killed, and how many operations this dog had been in, and how many lives this dog, you know, this whole thing, they built this whole thing around the dog. So they have all this entire military, theater coming in against a bunch of guys with guns that have no military experience, no military training, no real equipment other than, you know, guns that were probably stolen from the Israeli caches. And that's it, you know. So the imbalance here is so striking. And the fact that Israel prides itself, they went in with all these special forces and they did this and they did that, you know, and still they, you know, the Palestinians put up a good fight. They do put up a good fight, but they don't stand a chance. But there is definitely, this year there's been an intensification of the assaults on that part of the West Bank because of the, you know, the emergence of emerging these cells of resistance, definitely.
There's a film right now that's on Netflix called Farha. It's directed by Doreen Salam, and it's been condemned by the Israeli government. They've accused it of, quote unquote, creating a false narrative. Can you talk about this film and whether or not it is, whether or not it creates a false narrative?
Yeah, it's interesting. The Israeli response just begs the phrase, you know, if the hat fits, wear it. It's an overreaction, you know. It's like, you know, somebody, you know, who steals and or doesn't, you know, somebody's accused of something and, you know, right away say, I didn't do it. Of course they did it. Of course it's true. Their reaction only solidifies the argument that this movie is absolutely true, you know, and that it is a small sample of something that was much greater.
And I should just explain that the movie, in the film, there is a Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian family.
Yeah.
And that's what people are objecting to, the fact that this was part of a film.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are films that show Americans kill innocent civilians. There are films that show Germans kill them. There's the films that show French soldiers kill civilians in North Africa. I mean, everybody, the films are allowed to depict anybody killing others except for Israeli Jews. You know, Israelis are exempt from that for some reason. So, but yeah, the Israeli response really only goes to show that this is absolutely true for anybody who had any doubts. It's a powerful film, very powerful. I watched it, and when it was over, I just had to sit there quietly for a while and you know, just sit there. I was speechless. It's very gutsy. The way it was done is gutsy. It's courageous. It's not what you expect, not what I expected. It's painful. It's emotionally, it grabs you emotionally. I mean, to a point where you feel, you know, this, you absolutely feel what is taking place in that movie. It touches you, you know, to the core. And it is, I believe, without any doubt, a small sample of something greater that took place in Palestine in 1948, and actually, in fact, continues to take place even today in Palestine. I think it's great that Netflix is showing it. I think it definitely should qualify as for an award of some sort. And I think people should watch it. I think many, many people should watch it. Number one, because it's an excellent film. And number two, because it depicts something that is real, that is true. And in many ways, this movie is unique because of the way it was made, because, you know, the drama, the artistic aspects of it are unique. So I would definitely encourage people to watch it. But again, the Israeli reaction is almost funny.
I mean, it's the reaction is the condemnation is based on the myth that something like this could not have happened.
Yeah,
that I mean, the founding of Israel was not, you know, that there was a morality or an attempt. I mean, Israel says this a lot, that they're always kind of, it's so unfortunate that this violence happens, that Israel takes all the precautions it possibly can to avoid this.
Yeah, except that we know, because we've seen it and we've heard it, Israeli politicians and Israeli commanders going to villages across Palestine and saying, you know, if you don't do what we say, it's going to happen to you too. Or saying, you know, Palestinians need to, you know, watch out what they do because we can bring about a second Nakba. So they like to play both sides, and you can't do that. But I think today, with all the books and the movies and, you know, all the information that's out there, Israel can deny the Nakba as much as it wants. The Nakba took place. It's still taking place. The disaster, the catastrophe, the destruction of Palestine is going on as we speak. And that story, that particular village, which, by the way, is a true story of one particular girl, could have been at any point in the last 75 years in Palestine, at any village, in any town throughout Palestine. I think it's commendable in a way that they did it in Jordan. They didn't ask for Israeli money or Israeli, you know, anything has to do with Israeli, you know, funding or anything like that.
Not that they would have gotten it.
Well, they may or they may not. I mean, sometimes they fund movies that we wouldn't expect. But the point is, they didn't even, you know, they did it in Jordan.
Right.
And I think she deserves, you know, credit for the courage to make the movie, not just because it portrays Israelis doing what they did, but because the way that she did it, the way in which she portrays it is unique and I think brilliant and courageous.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiots.substack.com. That was really interesting.
Yes, and if you want to check out Miko Pellard's book, recently reissued, it's called The General's Son, and a very unique experience going from, you know, being the son of a celebrated Israeli general to opposing Israel's very existence and speaking out very tirelessly about that, and a really interesting guy to hear from.
And to hear the extended interview where we talk about the double standards between the celebration of Ukrainian resistance and the condemnation of Palestinian alleged terrorism, go to usefulidiots.substack.com.
And of course, you also get our Thursday Throwdown, your midweek dose of media madness. All right, see you next week.
Hi, everyone. Hello, thank you so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For full episodes and extended interviews, please subscribe at usefulidiots.substack.com. You can subscribe on YouTube at youtube.com/usefulidiots for clips, live streams, and full episodes. Also, subscribe to us wherever you find your podcast. Follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod and use the hashtag usefulidiotspod. Join us Mondays at 10 a.m. for the Useful Idiots Monday Morning Show, where we discuss the Sunday morning news shows so you don't have to watch them.